Good afternoon, and welcome to the November meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum. Since 1985, the Midcoast Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and their guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, the forum is delighted to have as its speaker Richard Downs, an expert on U.S.-Brazilian relations. He's a Bangor native whose first exposure to South America came as a high school student when he spent a summer in Quito, Ecuador, on an American Field Service program. His experience with Brazil began with a year's residence near Rio in 1982, conducting research for his doctoral dissertation. He subsequently served for 4 years as the Brazil desk officer for plans and policy on the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the chairmanships of Admiral William Crow and General Colin Powell, and prepared recommendations on national policy issues related to Brazil. He's formerly Associate Dean of Academics at the Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies of the National Defense University and Professor of History at the United States Air Force Academy. His topic today is what Brazil's emergence as a global player means for the United States. So let's give a warm Midcoast Forum welcome to Richard Downs.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mac. It's a great pleasure to be back in the great state of Maine. Thank you very much for your hospitality, for the invitation to be here. It is indeed a pleasure to share some ideas about Brazil and with such a distinguished group. Before we get going, I'd like to ask how many of you have been to Brazil, if we could have a show of hands. My goodness, that's impressive. And I presume that those who have not been to Brazil would like to go to Brazil at some point. Lots of us in Maine have had an interest in Brazil for a long time. We go back to the 19th century. Two of the first consul generals in Rio de Janeiro were from Bangor, were Bangor lawyers, Gorham Parks and Edward Kent. A very talented gentleman from Pittston, which is south of Augusta, was the U.S. consul in Porto Alegre from 1863 to 73. John Mills was a geologist from Bangor who ran a gold mine in Brazil in 1879 and 80. And in the 21st century, Ambassador Patrick Duddy, also from Bangor, was the consul general for the United States in Sao Paulo. And of course, Ambassador Duddy went on to be the ambassador to Venezuela and is still very active today in U.S.-Latin American relations. But to really get an understanding for what is going on in Brazil, we have to kind of change pace and ask and what it means for the United States and ask, what is the mood in Brazil? How are Brazilians looking at what's happening as they approach 2013? And to answer that question, I'm going to put forward a phrase that is, God is Brazilian. Now, don't be alarmed. I'm not a frustrated missionary trying to bring in some religion from south of the border. Rather, whether or not God is Brazilian has been a constant discussion within Brazil for a long time. The idea stems from the notion that Brazil is so rich and the land is so plentiful that God himself must have decided to reside there after the creation. When things are going well, God is Brazilian. Such as in 2006 when President Lula could announce a vast oil field discovery off the coast of Brazil, he could say, it is proven that God is Brazilian. But God is not always Brazilian, unfortunately. When Brazil loses a World Cup match, or when inflation is at 45% per month as it was in the 1990s, God is not Brazilian. I think the best example I could give you, a recent event in which some folks from Brazil probably thought God is Brazilian, occurred in September of this year when a Brazilian TAM airliner was trying to land at New York's Kennedy Airport. It made two passes past the tower, and the tower verified that the nose wheel was cocked in the 90-degree position. And this meant that if indeed the airplane had landed with the nose wheel cocked, it would have been perhaps a serious accident. Well, just as the airplane was touching down, literally a few feet from the runway, the nose wheel seemingly miraculously rotated to the 90-degree forward position, and the airplane landed without an incident. So I suspect those folks thought that day, yes, indeed, God is Brazilian. So in order to pursue this theme, I want to just sort of touch on four main ideas. And it's hard in 45 minutes to really cover everything that's going on in Brazil and address all of your concerns. But these, I'll try to hit the high points, and then if we have time, hopefully for discussion, we can do that. I want to refresh perhaps your college history or geography course on what is Brazil, very briefly. What does it mean, secondly, that Brazil is an emerging power? What are the indicators of that? Thirdly, what are some of Brazil's ongoing challenges? And they're not few, they're significant. And then finally, the bottom line, what does Brazil's new status mean for the United States? Now, all of us have images of Brazil. The Carmen Miranda hat, the Pelé bicycle kick, those are just part of Brazil. Really, to understand Brazil, we have to set those stereotypes aside and realize that Brazil, number one, is part of Latin America, but it is different from the rest of Latin America because of its Portuguese heritage and its size. Brazil is not for beginners. Brazil is large and complex, the world's fifth largest country. As you can see from this little graph, major European countries, all of them, fit within the geographical confines of Brazil. Brazil is 2,700 miles long and about 2,700 miles wide. Brazil is ethnically and religiously diverse. Whites make up about 47% of the population. 43% are mulatto, or part of them, a mixture of black and white. Some 7% are African. Asians are 1.1%. And indigenous, about 0.4%, or about 800,000 folks. Religiously, it has traditionally been Roman Catholic, but Catholicism is declining in its impact. Protestantism, or evangelismo, as it's known in Brazil, is the fastest growing religious group, now 22% of the population. There are others who are spiritualists or no religion at all, and indeed a very complex religious and cultural mosaic. This came home to me one day when I was in Brazil. I was taking care of the home for a U.S. missionary, a Protestant missionary, who was going to the Holy Land. And my gardener was an Afro-Brazilian, and he and I would talk from time to time. And one day I asked him about his religion, and he said, "Oh, I practice Candomblé." Candomblé is an African religion with all kinds of different images from Christianity. And I said, "Well, that's interesting. I'm Catholic." And he said, "Well, I'm Catholic too." So that brought home the idea that traditional divisions and traditional categories really don't fit within Brazil. Brazil is geographically and climatically diverse. There are five regions. There are 26 states, one federal district, five regions, the Amazon basin in the north, the Northeast, that has 28% of the population, but 14% of the gross domestic product, impoverished. The south, the south here, that is the economic engine of Brazil, including the state of São Paulo, which produces about one-third of Brazil's GDP. The southeast, which is largely agricultural, pastoral, economy very similar to neighboring Uruguay and Argentina. And then we have the center-west, which in many ways is a new dynamic area of Brazil. It's called also the Faroeste, or the Far West, picking up on the American concept. This is the home to Brasilia, now 52 years old. It's also the home to a lot of cattle raising and soybean activities that are taking down the virgin forests, which are the basis for the way of life for a lot of Brazil's indigenous people. Brazilians have historically lived along the coast, and that is no exception today. You can see this area here. Basically, it was traditionally, in the colonial times, the area most efficient for crops, most accessible to the world market, and it still is that case today. Brazil manifests high levels of poverty and income inequality. In 2011, 21% of the population lived below the poverty line, and 8.5% of the population, or some 16 million people, live in extreme poverty, making less than $1.25 per day. Now, as you can see here, the average per capita for São Paulo is high, $32,000 to $40,000 per person on an annual basis. And we go up to Maranhão and Piauí in the northeast, it drops dramatically, less than half of the national average or below. Now, pardon me for saying this. I'm embarrassed to repeat it, but for most audiences, you have to just stress that, of course, Brazilians speak Portuguese. But a lot of Americans and other folks from other regions go to Brazil speaking Spanish. And they say, all we have to do is change a few verb endings and, you know, hold our nose a little bit more nasal intonation, it works. That is very dangerous. There are plenty of cognates, which are words that are the same, appear to be the same in both languages, but they're also false cognates. And sometimes the false cognate is the exact opposite of what the meaning could be. So sometimes people say one thing, and the meaning comes out in Brazil exactly the opposite. So Portanhol, as it's called, is very, very dangerous. Now, that's, in a nutshell, a quick overview of Brazil. How did God become Brazilian? And this is a very, very quick sort of history lesson that I'll share with you, as some of it I've lived personally. And we have to go back to the 1990s. The early 1990s were not good times in Brazil. Brazil had been attempting to work its way toward a functional democracy after 3 decades of military rule, but was hit by a series of reverses. In 1985, the first democratically elected president, Tancredo Neves, died before he could take office. In 1989, this gentleman here, a very telegenic, handsome, dynamic politician from the Northeast, was elected, the first directly elected president of Brazil since the 1960s. He had a very ambitious program of privatization, but very soon it became obvious that he was very interested in filling his pockets first. And the corruption investigation that followed and the scandal that followed led to his impeachment in 1992. In his place stepped in Itamar Franco, who was a traditional politician who really could not keep the train on the tracks. Inflation became extremely serious, hitting 2,000% per year. And perhaps the straw that broke the camel's back occurred in 1994 when Franco was on nationwide television on the presidential reviewing stand for a carnival parade. He was seen exchanging kisses with a 27-year-old scantily clad samba dancer. People began to ask the question, as Charles de Gaulle reputedly said in the 1960s, is Brazil a serious country? Well, the answer was, in the end, yes. Fernando Henrique Cardoso, an academic who Franco had the good sense to appoint as the finance minister, came up with a plan known as the Real Plan. The Real Plan created a new currency. They had 7 currencies in the previous 8 years. It created monetary stability, lowering tariffs, creating incentives for investment by following through in the privatization program that Collor had introduced. He introduced fiscal discipline, limited transactions from the federal government to the state, and at the same time, he implemented the southern common market known as Mercosur. Mercosur is a union today between Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil. It now includes Venezuela, but that would increase Brazil's export trade to these nearby countries. Along the way, he also privatized major sectors of the economy, including the telecommunications sector, chemical sector, mining, and indeed allowed for the first time stability that would allow investment to come into Brazil. The results were very good. You can see here the monthly inflation rates starting from 77 creeping up, and really under Collor actually hitting unacceptable levels. The Real Plan came in, and inflation went down to 1 to 2% per year. It is now at about 5.4-5.5%. It's still an issue within Brazil, but the Real Plan and monetary stability brought confidence to the Brazilian monetary system, which allowed folks to begin investing, savings and investing, knowing they could get a return on their investment. Also, when we look at exports from Brazil to Mercosur, might be a little hard to see, but basically from 1992 to 2009, Brazilian exports to Mercosur countries quadrupled. So these reforms by 2003 were so positive that actually there was a movie released in Brazil, and the name of the movie was Deus é Brasileiro, God is Brazilian. It was an era of buoyancy, it was an era of optimism. This Brazilian traditional optimism about life had been translated into an effective government policy. Well, these policies were continued by Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, president from 2003 to 2010. Now, there was a lot of consternation when he was elected presidency because of his background. He had come from the impoverished Northeast. He, as a young man, had sold oranges on the streets of São Paulo to support his family. He was a lathe operator. He became head of a metal workers union and led a successful strike in 1979. He then formed a party known as the Workers' Party, or PT, Partido Trabalhista, but it wasn't a standard Marxist party because it incorporated a lot of folks from the left, including folks from the Catholic Church, social activists, and they stressed citizen participation and redistributive taxes. Whoever heard that before. He came in, and despite all of the fears to the contrary, he actually was quite moderate and conservative and sustained the reforms that Fernando Henrique had put in place. He gave the central bank greater autonomy. He advanced a development agenda for Brazil, called the Program of Accelerated Development. He fostered ties with the developing world and began to assert Brazil's international influence. Brazil had always sort of been there as a bystander or as a secondary partner, but Brazil now wanted to be on the first team. And as a result of these reforms, confidence returned from the international investment community. This is net foreign direct investment on an annual basis. You can see by 2011, they're up to $76 billion in that year. Brazil is the second largest recipient of direct foreign investment in the world after China. We also saw, coupled with the economic reforms, a social reform that is known as conditioned monthly transfer. The goal is to eradicate the extreme poverty in Brazil. This program had started on a local basis in 2001. Lula thought it was a good idea when he was elected. He implemented it nationally. And the idea is to tie school attendance and basic health practices to a monthly bonus check. This check comes if the children, it's on a per-child basis, children 6 years or older, if they attend school 85% of the time, and the mother gives them, make sure they get their vaccinations, and she, if she is nursing or pregnant, attends health counseling classes, will get a monthly payment up to 306 reais. Children, families now receiving that benefit are almost 14 million. Interestingly enough, it's paid directly to the mothers on a cash card because the women in Brazil are almost always responsible for the household expenditures. The average benefit is really not very much on U.S. standards, $60 per month. But if you compare that to the poverty rate, basically that means that you're doubling the income for that family on a monthly basis or even more. So this has been very successful. Now, as if all of this were not enough, impact of this is that inequality has dropped drastically in Brazil. Brazil has typically been one of the world's most unequal societies. According to the Gini coefficient, now it's down to the 16th most unequal society, which is a tremendous drop, as you can see. When we look at GDP per capita in 1990, somewhere below 8,000 per person, all the way up here in 2011, in excess of 11,000 per person. Now again, by US standards, that's not a large amount. We're somewhere in excess of 40,000. But in terms of growth in Brazil, it is a significant improvement in terms of the income available to every Brazilian. Strong foreign reserves have flowed into Brazil. Brazil was always the international debtor, always going to the IMF for money. That has changed to the point where in 2010, IMF could Brazil could offer to the IMF that they would buy $10 billion in IMF bonds in order to help developing countries. Clearly, the tables had turned. Brazil had now gone from a debtor to a creditor country with a high degree of reliability and confidence. Part of this was associated with the high commodity prices. Those of you who may have read the recent Foreign Affairs article talks about this. Impact of this issue, but also I think the positive social engineering and Brazil's effective use of its agricultural base to keep food prices down and to generate massive exports is part of the reason for all of this happening. When we look at Brazil in the international arena, I think this is where Brazil's visibility has risen, at least for those of us in the United States, on a more on a more significant basis. Brazil was the leader in the founding of the Union of South American Nations, dedicated to creating a South American identity and infrastructure, a greater unity for Latin America and the Caribbean. It's been a leader in the formation of the G20 Economic Forum, which is gradually having greater influence than the G8 group of the Worldwide Economic Council. It was the leader in the founding of the South American Defense Council, the argument being that we South Americans can work together to reform our security or solve our security issues. It's also been the leader in the formation of the BRIC group of countries. Now, this is as many of you probably know, this is a Goldman Sachs invention. It was an analytical paper that basically recognized that the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are being responsible for a majority of the world's growth. And Brazil and the other countries have taken this notion to its logical conclusion. They have started to work together through a series of summits and coordinated policies, now including South Africa, in order to promote their interests as major growing nations in the world economy. According to an IMF study in January of this year, the BRIC countries will be responsible for 56% of the world's economic growth in 2012. Brazil has also been very, very forthright in supporting its own economic interests in South America and Africa, pushing for favorable terms for its investment, especially on oil and gas, and generally supporting a greater role for Brazilian firms, Brazilian companies in the international economic arena. Now, as if all of this were not good enough to make God Brazilian, Brazil began to discover massive deposits of oil and gas off its coast. Brazil had been searching for oil and gas within the mainland for decades with very, very unflattering results or unproductive results. In the 1970s, they began drilling in the Campos Basin off Rio de Janeiro. They became, the Brazil National Oil Company, Petrobras, became very proficient in offshore drilling, and they began exploring further and further out in the 1980s. They discovered these groups, this oil and gas in an area known as the pre-salt area off the coast of Rio de Janeiro. It is now called the pre-salt province. This is an area about 170 miles off the coast. It's about 500 miles in length and 125 miles in width. And this is the next slide shows it in a little bit more detail. The estimate of the pre-salt province, estimates vary widely, actually. This slide from Petrobras in 2011 put the total estimate of barrels of oil equivalent at almost 34 billion barrels of oil equivalent. More recent estimates have put it up as far as 60 billion barrels, and I've even seen 90 billion barrels of oil equivalent to be extracted from this pre-salt province. Now, that is good news, and is also a tremendous challenge for the national oil industry, because drilling in this arena can be extremely difficult, dangerous, and costly. In 2001, a platform known as P-36 suffered an explosion in one of its pillars. A lot of folks criticized some of the engineering design for this. The rig sank. 11 lives were lost. And there was a total loss for the platform that had only been drilling for 1 year. And the cost of that platform was in excess of $400 million. Exploiting the pre-salt province will require a whole fleet of floating production, storage, and offloading vessels. These vessels receive the oil as it comes up, mixed with other chemicals from the surface. They initially separate the oil and then transfer it to tankers or to pipelines if they're close enough to shore so that it can go forward to refineries. When we look at how to do this, it becomes even more interesting because the pre-salt province lies beneath at least a mile of water, and then beneath the post-salt layer, the salt layer, which can be highly corrosive, and then the pre-salt layer. So we're talking about an additional 4 to 5 miles below the subsurface in order to bring this oil out. As I mentioned, it's very costly. We're talking about building, or Petrobras is talking about building 28 drilling rigs, 15 of these FPSOs, 49 tankers. And this has been complicated by a Brazilian decision to require that the equipment and services have 70% local contact. And some of the foreign media and foreign companies are starting to criticize this because it effectively is excluding them to a degree from participation in this process. It's also complicated because the price of oil is, in the future, is generally unknown. Some analysts say that the cost, total production cost, not the lift cost, total production cost could be as much as $100 per barrel, whereas shale oil, according to one expert, costs only $70 per barrel to bring to market. However, the former head of Petrobras assured investors in 2011 that the total cost was only $40 to $45 per barrel. So this is a big bet, quite frankly. And really what it means is that Brazil has the opportunity if all of this works out with respect to oil. This is really one of Brazil's foremost positive indicators of future growth. Here we see oil production at in the blue, demand at in the red, and oil production steadily surpassing demand to the point where Brazil is producing nearly 6 million barrels of oil per day by 2020. So, if all of this works, and things will be going forward in a very positive direction, there are still other challenges that Brazil's current leaders have to face as they look to the future. And I listed four of these, which we can discuss briefly here. First, we're looking at sustaining the middle class, which is President Dilma Rousseff, the new president of Brazil's main challenge. Sustaining Brazil's international image is important. Overcoming infrastructure deficits, also critical, and finally reducing crime. Now, Dilma Rousseff is a very interesting person. She's a former guerrilla leader. She's now the president. She was the daughter of an immigrant lawyer and a Brazilian school teacher in the 1960s. She became disillusioned with poverty in Brazil. She joined a clandestine leftist group. Although she says she never participated in any violent activities, she was apprehended by Brazilian authorities for opposition to the government. She was tortured for 22 days in some very grotesque ways and kept in prison for 3 years. Their code name was Estela. She was a local politician until 2003 when Lula selected her to be his Minister of Mines and Energy. In 2005, she became Lula's chief of staff. And her effectiveness in directing Lula's program led Lula to select her as his hand-picked successor. Since the 1st of January 2011, she has been that. She has been going forward to say that she totally supports the middle class in order to, you know, make that Brazilian dream, make God is Brazilian, come to reality. She said, what I want my legacy to be is this country to be, to have an increasing middle class, to be highly competitive and highly educated. Now, that middle class is important here, as we see, again, a forecast from the Brazilian finance ministry would go from 95 million in 2009 to 113 million in 2014. These are new consumers, many folks with access to credit and consumer goods for the very first time in a region or in a country in which there are no limits on interest, and there are really no ways of checking credit, so folks very carefully watch the default rates on these new consumers to see if they can actually participate. But their success as a middle class really is key to the legitimacy of the government and the fact that Brazil can sustain this image that things are going very well. Dilma has attacked poverty. She's fighting corruption. She's had several corruption scandals, including her chief of staff was dismissed. And she's very, very interested in containing inflation, the perennial sort of devil in Brazil, in order to make sure that the wages that are passed out are still meaningful. You can see here the minimum wage adjustment, and I don't have the graph for real terms, but it is largely followed in real terms here, the middle class. The working class is, in fact, very positively oriented towards those changes that are happening. Now, she's faced with a slower economic growth, partly because of slower growth in China, which is the recipient of lots of Brazil's exports. In 2012, the latest growth indicators are about 1% growth so far. So that's not good news. Despite that, Dilma has a 77% approval rating, and there's every notion to think that she'll be elected, reelected in 2014. Now, perhaps some of you know more about the challenges related to managing the Amazon region and those expectations to measure up to the World Cup 2014 and the Olympics 2016. In October of 2009, when Brazil was awarded the prize of being the site for the Olympic Games in 2016, Brazilian President Lula said, "Today is the day that Brazil has gained its international citizenship. The world has finally recognized that this is Brazil's time. We have proven that we are citizens too." Well, that's a very forthright statement, and I think there are areas, indeed, that offer opportunities for Brazil to live up to international expectations. The Amazon is critical because it's seen both as the reservoir of natural resources and a critical national security zone by the Brazilian military. It holds 20% of the world's fresh water. There are all kinds of pressures, both nationally and internationally, for its use or non-use. Brazilian nationalists see that they have the right to develop the Amazon as they see fit. This is a Brazilian resource, and if we want to use it for cattle or for soybeans, that's our prerogative. International environmental activists, on the other hand, see the Amazon as an international resource. The idea being that in a period of global warming where carbon monoxide levels are important, if you start burning the Amazon or continue to take down the Amazon, the degradation of the plants that have been taken down will release more carbon into the atmosphere and then accelerate global warming. So they are pressuring, with the assistance of Brazilian environmental activists, to limit the deforestation within the Amazon region and to control growth in the region as much as they can. Now, the Brazilian military, and I'm personally familiar with this because I led, at one point, I brought a group of American military officers into the Amazon, and we met with the Brazilian military, and they made it very clear. This indeed is the Brazilian Amazon, and they had a big stick that really kind of slapped against the board to emphasize the point. The National Defense Strategy says that Brazil will repudiate by actions of development and defense any attempt of external imposition on its decisions regarding the preservation, development, and defense of the Amazon region. And there are other even more strident elements of that which you can look at if you take a look at the defense strategy. Most recently, the struggle has associated with the Forest Code. The Forest Code sets out the ways or the requirements for reforestation for those large landowners who are taking down Brazil's virgin forests or even small landowners. It's been the product of 10 years of lobbying by the agricultural and cattle raising interests, and in May of this year, Dilma was being pressured to veto the entire bill. Well, what she did was veto only portions of the bill, those portions that set requirements on small landowners to reforest the area that they were occupying. So it made it less demanding on small landowners while retaining the demands that large landowners reforest the areas they're working at a particular rate. The government says that this is indeed a good balance between the pressures to maintain the Amazon and at the same time allow for a certain level of development. Now, another important challenge is this, as if this were not enough. Oh, here's the Amazon deforestation rates. As you can see, better monitoring, better international cooperation, satellite monitoring has resulted in a decrease of more than 50%. In 2006, we had 14,000 or so kilometers deforested. In 2011, only 6,000. And some of you saw a recent New York Times article that more deforestation is taking place in the Amazon countries outside of Brazil than is taking place within Brazil. So Brazil is making some headway on this issue. Even, I think, more challenging when we look at the Olympic Games and the World Cup is the infrastructure issue. The heavy dependence upon roads for moving everything makes transportation extremely difficult. And I don't know if you can see this graph, but 58% or so of all transportation of goods occurs via roads. Now, this is no surprise for those of us who tried to get around in Brazil. I have many not-so-fond memories of going from downtown São Paulo to the airport of Guarulhos. It is... because all of the traffic from southern Brazil and northern Brazil had to pass on this single road going around São Paulo, we would meet all kinds of trucks, concrete trucks, transport trucks, personal vehicles, buses, et cetera, going back and forth between north and south Brazil. Even though it was only a distance of 13 miles, I regularly allocated 3 hours to get to the airport, and I usually had to use the entire 3 hours. Now, this was great if you wanted to get to know your boss better, or had great conversations with taxi drivers. I've had a lot of those. But what it means is that Brazil's transport system is inadequate to meet the demands of Brazil. Now, there is an in-place infrastructure development program that is trying to remedy this, and it is well-funded, and including the Beltway issue around São Paulo, it has been in the planning stages since 1952, but the argument is that it will be completed by 2014, and I have every expectation that that will occur. Especially with Brazilian exports booming, there is an urgent need to get a better infrastructure in Brazil's railroads, and Brazil's ports, and Brazil's airports. So part of this dilemma is accommodating the folks that are coming for the World Cup. And to accommodate them, Brazil has embarked upon an ambitious infrastructure development program. We're going to have an estimated 500,000 soccer fans from all over the world visit, participate, and witness games in 12 host cities. Now, this is going to be an extremely difficult logistical issue because these host cities range all the way from Manaus in the Amazon region, which has no way to get back and forth via road efficiently, down to Porto Alegre in the south. The Brazilian decisions mean that they are building new stadiums in almost every one of the host cities, and they're even renovating the Maracanã Stadium here in this upper left image, because the Maracanã did not meet the FIFA World Cup standards. It did not have separate seats. It had inadequate restroom areas, inadequate media areas, et cetera, et cetera. I saw a YouTube with the engineer for the project said it would have been easier to blow up the Maracanã and start all over again than to do what they're doing. But they're getting it done. The Brazilian government is spending $15.7 billion to prepare for the World Cup. Now, the World Cup is merely the warm-up for the Olympics 2016. The idea is they will build upon upgrades that have occurred for the World Cup. They will have three new major highway and bus routes to connect the four major Olympic venues with each other, and ease traffic between the airport and the region where the Olympics will be held. It's called Jacarepaguá. It's an area which I know very well. A lot of conferences have been held in this region. They are taking down a racetrack in the area to build the Olympic Park. The same company that was awarded the contract for building London's Olympic Park has been awarded the contract for building the Olympic Park, or the Master Olympic Park, in Rio de Janeiro. There are also plans to revamp the port area to make it much more attractive to international visitors, and in general to transform the transportation infrastructure for Rio de Janeiro itself. And that's important because if you see this hill here, the only way to get between this area, Jacarepaguá, and the rest of Rio, Leblon, Copa, etc., is through a tunnel that was cut many, many years ago. So the idea is that they'll bring a new metro line and all kinds of new bus private vehicle transport down into this region. There's also a need for new hotels. Even with 300 new hotels planned or under construction, there is an estimate there'll be a deficit of 20,000 hotel rooms. And some 8,000 of these are going to be met by cruise ships that would be positioned in the port of Brazil. So closely related to providing the right levels of infrastructure for both the World Cup and the Olympics is fighting crime. Now, crime is, any of us who've been in Brazil in the last 10 or 15 years know that street crime is a problem. And foreigners are often the targets because we very infrequently make police reports. They also use juveniles who, if they're caught, serve a lesser time than the adults, who are often hiding in the bushes, operating the scheme as it is in fact taking place. I have in fact been the victim of a mugging by three people in São Paulo who took all my cash without injuring me, but I was told, don't follow them or they'll kill you. I was also in a taxi one day in which a young teenager came to the car and with a 38 pistol to the head of the driver, said, "Give me your money and your watch." Fortunately, he didn't see me in the back before the car was able to move on. But more important than street crime is the crime that's associated with the favelas. This crime stems from the control by dope sellers in these 600 shanty towns that surround Brazil and countless others that surround other major, that surround Rio de Janeiro, and countless other cities. They have been left alone, largely, for the last 30 years because the police have not dared to go in to intervene. I don't know if any of you saw the city, Cidade de Deus, the City of God. It's a very raw kind of threatening environment, just even if you're sitting in your living room watching it. As a good friend of mine told me, after having been robbed of his Rolex watch and his BMW at gunpoint, he said, "We are in the middle of a civil war." The Brazilian response initially was to send the army in. And the army had special units that were to intervene in the favelas. But that doesn't work too well. The army is not that trained to handle civil situations. And secondly, the drug lords just went to the next door favela and continued on with their traffic. So now the government has come up, both the state and federal government, have come up with a plan called the Unit of Police Pacification. These are units that go into the favelas. They establish a physical presence in the favelas, patrol the streets, get to know the neighborhood. They're not community police that come in and go out at night. They stay there on a total 24-hour basis. This is initiating government control in these regions, in some cases for the very first time. There are about 30 of these UPPs, and there are plenty of videos on YouTube if you want to see how they work, in these favelas, and they are doing a good job. The property values are rising, crime is being reduced, and although there are occasional problems with corruption and police violence, the UPPs are an effective solution if indeed they can get enough of these units to control the majority of the favelas. Very closely linked to this is the issue of criminal gangs in the prisons. And the foremost criminal gang in the prisons is the PCC, Primeiro Comando da Capital. This was a São Paulo prison gang that has an estimated 160,000 members. They protest difficult conditions in Brazil's prisons, to the point of, in 2006, conducting coordinated attacks throughout the city of São Paulo. These attacks left 150 people dead. 82 city buses were torched, and sometimes in broad daylight, and 17 banks were vandalized. The PCC has been less visible since 2006, but they are conducting an ongoing assassination campaign against the police who have been organized to try to defeat them. There are also groups in Rio that are associated with the drug trade in the favelas that are equally criminal and equally difficult to deal with. Now, the good news is that the Brazilian government has responded to these challenges. Dilma has allocated $253 million to a campaign to stem the drug trade, and last November she set aside an additional $2 billion to try to treat the cause of this, that is drug addiction, in order to get the addicts into treatment centers and get them off the streets. Well, these are all serious challenges, but the fact that the Brazil of today has put forward coherent and funded remedies for each is extremely encouraging. Noted U.S. observer Riordan Rouette noted in his 2010 book, The New Brazil, that Brazil was facing a long road to political and social consolidation. But he said there is every expectation that breakthrough policies that were initiated in 1994 will be continued by the new president, and that is in fact the case. I certainly echo the optimism that Riordan Rouette expressed. Brazil today clearly is no longer the perpetual country of the future. Its new status merits our attention. So what does that mean for residents of Maine and citizens of the United States? First, I would say that Brazil's economic growth has an important economic consideration for us. It generates U.S. jobs. U.S., as noted on the slide, U.S. goods and services exports in Brazil in 2011 were $63 billion. Brazil is the eighth largest export market for U.S. goods. We have a goods and services trade surplus of $25 billion in 2011. That means that an estimated, at least in 2009, over 300,000 American jobs were supported by our exports to Brazil. And even in Maine, I was surprised to find we do, in fact, trade with Brazil. Some $33 million in 2010, according to the U.S. Brazil Business Council, largely in terms of paper goods and chemicals and transportation elements. The fact that Brazil is, there are a lot of forces toward green solutions in Brazil, and Maine has a lot of interest in the green economy, might mean that there are future opportunities there to interact between Brazil and Maine. We also see Brazil's economic growth benefiting U.S. investments. The U.S. stock of investments in Brazil, $66 billion in 2010. Sales in Brazil by U.S. majority-owned firms, almost $25 billion. And when you take a look at the top 50 companies in Brazil, it's not dominated by U.S. firms. Someone asked me last night, are we dominating the Brazilian economy? Are U.S. firms dominating the Brazilian economy? Clearly not. But in terms of specific sectors, General Motors, Esso, Texaco, Ford, and Cargill, an agricultural company, are some of the top 50 companies doing business in Brazil today. Now, Brazilian tourists come to the United States, and I'm not sure if we could bring them to Maine. I certainly hope there might be an opportunity there, because they spend a lot of money in the United States. Brazilians that are newly prosperous are coming to the United States in record numbers. And the average Brazilian tourist spends more than the average Japanese tourist, some $5,400 per person. And new U.S. visas for Brazilian visitors were more than 500,000 in 2010. When we look at 2016, some 2.8 million Brazilian visitors are forecast. The U.S. consulate in Sao Paulo extended the most visas of any consulate in the world. It's currently processing 2,300 visa applications per day. So there's a lot going on in terms of tourism. Perhaps that's something that we folks in Maine could take advantage of. And finally, in the political arena, in the international policy arena, as well as other economic cooperation areas, there's a lot that could be done through a stronger U.S.-Brazil partnership in the future, allowing oil companies and service providers to have greater participation in oil and gas exploration can assist Brazil raise its production as well as raise the overall global production of oil and gas. The U.S.-Brazil Cooperative Agreement on Biofuels has committed both countries to creating a global market for ethanol. We haven't seen much progress on that, but it indeed the framework is in place. We could and have been cooperating with the Brazilians on agricultural development for the last century. And U.S.-Brazil formal cooperation on agricultural development is taking place in Africa in order to find better ways to sustain agricultural development and defeat the world food crisis. On security issues, which I've written about extensively, supporting better coordination and cooperation in Brazil, with Brazil on security issues could help us deal with the tide of illegal drugs, deal with nuclear proliferation, and to keep terrorism out of the Americas. And finally, we all benefit from educational exchange that broadens the perspectives of U.S. students and creates lasting ties in the social and economic realms. So, in summary then, if you take away nothing from today's talk, remember this. You can always start a good conversation with a Brazilian by telling him or her that you heard that God is Brazilian, and you will hear lots of commentary in response. More seriously, I argue that sustaining close economic and political and social ties with an emerging Brazil strongly supports the national interests of the United States in a globalized world, and we need to find ways to do that. Some of the ways to do that are by being more informed about Brazil. There's plenty on the web about Brazil. Folks complain there's a lack of visibility in the cable news and all of that. That's true. But that doesn't mean you can't touch what is going on in Brazil on a daily basis. The Rio Times is available in English. The Brazilian Dispatch coagulates news from Brazil. There's a great movie called Middle of the World that's available on Netflix, which talks about the migration to Rio by a family over 12,000 miles on bicycle. And there are plenty of books, Skidmore and Rouet in particular, that give you a great overview for contemporary Brazil. So I've pretty much kept within my time. I thank you very much for your attention. That's my argument about Brazil, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Rich, that was great. That was really comprehensive and terrific. I'll start out, the first question is something you didn't get into, and that is, has U.S. policy had any effect on mitigating, or for that matter, exacerbating the situation of the, I think you said, 800,000 indigenous population of Brazil.
Yes. I think U.S. policy has an impact in a couple of arenas. One, the AID has a program that is aimed at promoting reforestation and effective use of indigenously habited forest. And I'm not sure what the funding level is on that, but we actually have a program that is designed to support those who see deforestation as a threat to Brazil's ecology. And I think the other side of that, the other pressure point, is that in the United States, there are a lot of folks that support the World Wildlife Fund and other NGOs that have a very close handle on what is going on in Brazil and do indeed exert pressure within the Brazilian government, especially the Environmental Protection Agency in Brazil, in order to make sure that things are handled in a less destructive way. So there are different ways to exert influence. And ultimately, the decision is a Brazilian decision. They argue development is their right and perhaps their obligation. There's a great dam that's being conducted or being developed on the Xingu River called Belo Monte Dam. And the environmental groups are having an impact in how the government manages the impact on the local economy and local populace, I think, to a positive degree. It won't satisfy all international environmentalists, but indeed there is activism in that arena.
Brazil and its neighbors. Mm-hmm. Brazil is obviously the key country in South America. How do its neighbors react to this, and how aggressive is it in its behavior towards
right.
its neighbors?
Right. I think there is a sort of a lingering concern about Brazil as an expansionist power in the region. I have seen a couple of books by diplomats from other countries in Brazil which create a whole new map of South America, which has Brazil very large and the other countries very small. One interpretation of the infrastructure development program of UNASUR would be to allow for greater access for Brazilian products through the Andean countries to the Pacific port so they wouldn't have to go all the way around the Horn in order to get to Asia. There was a dispute between Petrobras and the Bolivian government about Petrobras's investments, and that generated a very negative reaction within Brazil, which was smoothed over by diplomacy. The Argentines and the Brazilians are in this Mercosur agreement, but there are occasional discussions from the Argentine point of view about Brazilians dumping goods within the Argentine market and their disputes related to that. But I think on the basis, the South Americans are welcoming an initiative that seems to support their regional interests rather than strictly just supporting Brazilian interests. I do think they see a commonality of interests and reflected in two or three initiatives that they've taken as a group that have been very successful in dealing with South American problems that did not require or did not request the intervention of the United States.
Okay, we've only got time for a couple more. This relates to Chinese investment in Brazil. Is there a lot of Chinese investment in Brazil the way there is in, say, Africa? And specifically, are there many mines that are owned by the Chinese?
I really don't know the answer to that. I have seen some reference to the Chinese buying into oil concessions off the coast, and they are buying a portion of another company's interest in an oil sector. I think that, and the Chinese are important as constructors, for example, building ships for the Brazilian oil and gas boom, but I think they're far more important in terms of customers for Brazilian primary goods. The Chinese are important, though, in the telecommunications sector. And when I was in that sector, friends from companies that did business and produced products in North America lamented the fact that Chinese companies would go into Brazil and they would sell at the China cost, which was often 10% of what the American and Canadian companies could offer. So they were undercutting American companies in the region and getting a very good commercial hold as a result. Huawei has been seen as an effective partner in Brazil, has a lot of networks in Brazil. So I would say that they're doing business on a commercial basis in a very positive way. But overall investment, I'd have to dig that one up.
Okay, this is our next last question. Does Brazil suffer more than most of its neighbors from drug and violence problems in the favelas? Is that a more serious problem than Brazil? If so, why?
I think it is for two reasons. One, Brazil has become was initially an in-between point, a transshipment point for drugs that would come out of the Colombian Amazon and Colombian highlands, and then would be bound for Europe in particular. And, you know, the way that drug peddlers pay their associates is in drugs, of course, and that eventually leads to addiction on their part, and then a great internal demand within Brazil. I think the magnitude is greater in Brazil just because Brazil is such a large country and has so many opportunities for drug lords to peddle their goods within underprivileged or shanty towns and thereby take control in the absence of a government presence. That doesn't mean that drugs are not a problem in other Latin American countries, but as far as magnitude, I think it's much more serious in Brazil than others.
Okay, this last one is somebody's asking you to look into the future. What are current U.S.-Brazilian relations, and how do you think they will grow in the future? How ambitious is Brazil? How ambitious are they likely to become diplomatically, economically, and militarily?
Yeah, I would say there are two. The part of that question is what was not asked, and that is that what is the weight of relations between the United States and Brazil, official versus private? And I think it's far more important what happens in the private sector in terms of selling to Brazil and investing in Brazil and participating in this great oil and gas boom that's underway, rather than trying to think about what kind of appropriations we could put out on the AID basis. Dilma and President Obama have had meetings. President Obama went to Brazil, I think it was March of this year. It was a very cordial and unproductive, as far as I'm concerned, although a lot of agreements were signed. I mean, they ratified agreements to cooperate in those areas that I've mentioned. They ratified an agreement to work together on education. There's an LGBT agreement that both countries have agreed to work on in order to sort of lessen discrimination against the LGBT community in both countries. But I think the proof really is yet to come. I mean, is there substantial political will in both countries to work more closely with Brazil on these international issues, especially nuclear proliferation? And that was a big issue on Iran during the Lula administration. Lula's government put forward an initiative with the Turks that was an agreement that would have allowed Iran to have a certain amount of fissionable material. It was not an effective agreement from the point of view of our State Department. Secretary Clinton was very upset about it, and there was a lot of heartburn with respect to U.S.-Brazil relations on that issue. The current government, Dilma's government in Brazil, has not been so vociferous with respect to Iran, has not been supportive, openly at least, of the Iranian government. So I think that's a test. Can the United States and Brazil work together on the Iranian issue? Can the United States move forward on the biofuels agreement to make it an actual productive agreement that will promote the use of ethanol on an effective basis on a global basis? Do we have the symbolic trappings of a U.S.-Brazil relation in place? Do we have state dinners for Brazilian presidents? Do we have high visibility for interaction with Brazil? There is an ongoing exchange. There's been a lot of criticism in the literature starting from 1986 forward about the absence of a strategic relationship. There is a strong relationship. There is exchanges. There are exchanges at the ministerial, at the minister, at the secretary level, on almost every topic across the board. But the real issue, in my opinion, is there the political leadership in order to say that Brazil is one of our foremost partners and we need to work with them more closely? And that's a decision probably for the next Secretary of State and for the current or for the next Obama administration.